camps had to be raised from $1 a day to $3, with which the workers were receiving an equivalent of 60 cents a day in 1914 values. Everybody delightfully profited, except the very poor, the common workmen, the skilled workmen, the small businessmen, the professional men, and old couples living on annuities or their savings. These last did really suffer a little, as their incomes were cut in three. The workers, with apparently tripled wages, saw the cost of everything in the shops much more than triple. Agriculture, which was most of all to have profited from inflation, on the theory that the mercurial crop prices would rise faster than anything else, actually suffered the most of all, because after a first flurry of foreign buying, importers of American products found it impossible to deal in so skittish a market, and American food exports, such of them as were left, ceased completely. It was big business, that ancient dragon which Bishop Prang and Senator Windrip had gone forth to slay, that had the interesting time. With the value of the dollar changing daily, the elaborate systems of cost marking and credit of big business were so confused that presidents and sales managers sat in their offices after midnight with wet towels. But they got some comfort, because with the depreciated dollar they were able to recall all bonded indebtedness and, paying it off at the old face values, get rid of it at 30 cents on the hundred. With this, and the currency so wavering that employees did not know just what they ought to get in wages, and labor unions eliminated, the larger industrialists came through the inflation with perhaps double the wealth in real values that they had had in 1936. And two other planks in Windrip's encyclical, vigorously respected, were those eliminating the Negroes and patronizing the Jews. The former race took it the less agreeably. There were horrible instances in which whole southern counties with a majority of Negro population were overrun by the blacks and all property seized. True, their leaders alleged that this followed massacres of Negroes by Minutemen, but as Dr. McGoblin, Secretary of Culture, so well said, this whole subject was unpleasant and therefore not helpful to discuss. All over the country, the true spirit of Windrip's Plank 9 regarding the Jews was faithfully carried out. It was understood that the Jews were no longer to be barred from fashionable hotels, as in the hideous earlier day of race prejudice, but merely to be charged double rates. It was understood that Jews were never to be discouraged from trading, but were merely to pay higher graft to commissioners and inspectors, and to accept without debate all regulations, wage rates, and price lists decided upon by the stainless Anglo-Saxons of the various merchants' associations, and that all Jews of all conditions were frequently to sound their ecstasy in having found in America a sanctuary after their deplorable experiences among the prejudices of Europe. In Fort Beulah, Louis Rotenstern, since he had always been the first to stand up for the older official national anthems, the Star-Spangled Banner or Dixie, and now for Buzz and Buzz, since he had of old been considered almost an authentic friend by Francis Tasbrough and R.C. Crowley, and since he had often good-naturedly pressed the unrecognized Shad Ledoux's Sunday pants without charge, was permitted to retain his tailor shop, though it was understood that he was to charge members of the M.M. prices that were only nominal, or quarter nominal. But one Harry Kinderman, a Jew who had profiteered enough as agent for maple sugar and dairy machinery, so that in 1936 he had been paying the last installment on his new bungalow and on his Buick, had always been what Shad Ledoux called a fresh kike. He had laughed at the flag, the church, and even Rotary. Now he found the manufacturers canceling his agencies without explanation. By the middle of 1937, he was selling Frankfurters by the road, and his wife, who had been so proud of the piano and the old American pine cupboard in their bungalow, was dead from pneumonia caught in the one-room tar-paper shack into which they had moved. At the time of Windrip's election, there had been more than 80,000 relief administrators employed by the federal and local governments in America. With the labor camps absorbing most people on relief, this army of social workers, both amateurs and long-trained professional uplifters, was stranded. The Minutemen controlling the labor camps were generous. They offered the charitarians the same dollar a day that the proletarians received, with special low rates for board and lodging. But the cleverer social workers received a much better offer: to help list every family and every unmarried person in the country with his or her finances, professional ability, military training, and, most important and most tactfully to be ascertained, his or her secret opinion of the MMs and of the corpos in general. A good many of the social workers indignantly said that this was asking them to be spies, stool pigeons for the American au gay payu. These were, on various unimportant charges, sent to jail, or later to concentration camps, which were also jails, but the private jails of the MMs, unshackled by any old-fashioned, nonsensical prison regulations. In the confusion of the summer and early autumn of 1937, local MM officers had a splendid time making their own laws, and such congenital traitors and bellyachers as Jewish doctors, Jewish musicians, Negro journalists, socialistic college professors, young men who preferred reading or chemical research to manly service with the MMs, women who complained when their men had been taken away by the MMs and had disappeared, were increasingly beaten in the streets or arrested on charges that would not have been very familiar to pre-corpo jurists. And increasingly, the bourgeois counter-revolutionists began to escape to Canada, just as once by the Underground Railroad, the Negro slaves had escaped into that free northern air. In Canada, as well as in Mexico, Bermuda, Jamaica, Cuba, and Europe, these lying red propagandists began to publish the vilest little magazines, accusing the corpos of murderous terrorism, allegations that a band of six MMs had beaten an aged rabbi and robbed him, that the editor of a small labor paper in Patterson had been tied to his printing press and left there while the MMs burned the plant, that the pretty daughter of an ex-farmer labor politician in Iowa had been raped by giggling young men in masks. To end this cowardly flight of the lying counter-revolutionists, many of whom, once accepted as reputable preachers and lawyers and doctors and writers and ex-congressmen and ex-army officers, were able to give a wickedly false impression of corpoism and the MMs to the world outside America, the government quadrupled the guards who were halting suspects at every harbor and at even the minutest trails crossing the border. And in one quick raid, it poured MM stormtroopers into all airports, private or public, and all aeroplane factories, and thus, they hoped, closed the air lanes to skulking traitors. As one of the most poisonous counter-revolutionists in the country, ex-Senator Walt Trowbridge, Windrip's rival in the election of 1936, was watched night and day by a rotation of 12 MM guards. But there seemed to be small danger that this opponent, who, after all, was a crank but not an intransigent maniac, would make himself ridiculous by fighting against the great power which, per Bishop Prang, heaven had been pleased to send for the healing of distressed America. Trowbridge remained prosaically on a ranch he owned in South Dakota, and the government agent commanding the MMs, a skilled man trained in breaking strikes, reported that on his tapped telephone wire and in his steamed-open letters, Trowbridge communicated nothing more seditious than reports on growing alfalfa. He had with him no one but ranch hands, and in the house an innocent aged couple. Washington hoped that Trowbridge was beginning to see the light. Maybe they would make him ambassador to Britain, Vice Sinclair. On the 4th of July, when the MMs gave their glorious but unfortunate tribute to the chief and the five-pointed star, Trowbridge gratified his cowpunchers by holding an unusually pyrotechnic celebration. All evening, skyrockets flared up, and round the home pasture glowed pots of Roman fire. Far from cold-shouldering the MM guards, Trowbridge warmly invited them to help set off rockets and join the gang in beer and sausages. The lonely soldier boys off there on the prairie, they were so happy shooting rockets. An aeroplane with a Canadian license, a large plane, flying without lights, sped toward the rocket-lighted area and, with engine shut off so that the guards could not tell whether it had flown on, circled the pasture outlined by the Roman fire and swiftly landed. The guards had felt sleepy after the last bottle of beer. Three of them were napping on the short, rough grass. They were rather disconcertingly surrounded by men in masking flying helmets, men carrying automatic pistols, who handcuffed the guards that were still awake, picked up the others, and stored all 12 of them in the barred baggage compartment of the plane. The raider's leader, a military-looking man, said to Walt Trowbridge, "Ready, sir?" "Yep. Just take those 4 boxes, will you please, Colonel?" The boxes contained photostats of letters and documents. Unregally clad in overalls and a huge straw hat, Senator Trowbridge entered the pilot's compartment. High and swift and alone, the plane flew toward the premature northern lights. Next morning, still in overalls, Trowbridge breakfasted at the Fort Garry Hotel with the mayor of Winnipeg. A fortnight later, in Toronto, he began the republication of his weekly, A Lance for Democracy, and on the cover of the first number were reproductions of 4 letters indicating that before he became president, Berzelius Windrip had profited through personal gifts from financiers to an amount of over $1 million. To Doremus Jessup, to some thousands of Doremus Jessups, were smuggled copies of the Lance, though possession of it was punishable, perhaps not legally, but certainly effectively, by death. But it was not till the winter, so carefully did his secret agents have to work in America, that Trowbridge had in full operation the organization called by its operatives the New Underground, the NU, which aided thousands of counter-revolutionists to escape into Canada. Chapter 18. In the little towns, there is the abiding peace that I love, and that can never be disturbed by even the noisiest smart alecks from these haughty megalopolises like Washington, New York, and etc. 0 hour. Berzelius Windrip. Doremus's policy of wait and see, like most Fabian policies, had grown shaky. It seemed particularly shaky in June 1937, when he drove to North Beulah for the 40th graduation anniversary of his class in Isaiah College. As the custom was, the returned alumni wore comic costumes. His class had sailor suits, but they walked about bald-headed and lugubrious in these well-meant garments of joy, and there was a look of instability even in the eyes of the 3 members who were ardent corpos, being local corpo commissioners. After the first hour, Doremus saw little of his classmates. He had looked up his familiar correspondent, Victor Loveland, teacher in the classical department who, a year ago, had informed him of President Owen J. Peasley's ban on criticism of military training. At its best, Loveland's jerry-built imitation of an Anne Hathaway cottage had been no palace. Isaiah assistant professors did not customarily rent palaces. Now, with the pretentiously smart living room heaped with burlap-covered chairs and rolled rugs and boxes of books, it looked like a junk shop. Amid the wreckage sat Loveland, his wife, his 3 children, and 1 Dr. Arnold King, experimenter in chemistry. "What's all this?" said Doremus. "I've been fired. As too radical," growled Loveland. "Yes, and his most vicious attack has been on Glicknow's treatment of the use of the aorist in Hesiod," wailed his wife. "Well, I deserve it, for not having been vicious about anything since A.D. 300. Only thing I'm ashamed of is that they're not firing me for having taught my students that the corpos have taken most of their ideas from Tiberius, or maybe for having decently tried to assassinate District Commissioner Reek, said Loveland. "Where are you going?" inquired Doremus.
"That's just it. We don't know."
"Oh, first to my dad's house, which is a 6-room packing box in Burlington. Dad's got diabetes. But teaching, President Peasley kept putting off signing my new contract and just informed me 10 days ago that I'm through. Much too late to get a job for next year. Myself, I don't care a damn. Really, I don't. I'm glad to have been made to admit that as a college prof I haven't been, as I so liked to convince myself, any Erasmus Junior, inspiring noble young souls to dream of chaste classic beauty, save the mark, but just a plain hired man, another counter-jumper in the marked-down classics goods department, with students for bored customers, and as subject to being hired and fired as any janitor. Do you remember that in Imperial Rome, the teachers, even the tutors of the nobility, were slaves? Allowed a lot of leeway, I suppose, in their theories about the anthropology of Crete, but just as likely to be strangled as the other slaves. I'm not kicking. Dr. King, the chemist, interrupted with a whoop. Sure you're kicking. Why the hell not? With 3 kids? Why not kick? Now me, I'm lucky. I'm half Jew, one of these sneaking, cunning Jews that Buzz Windrip and his boyfriend Hitler tell you about. So cunning, I suspected what was going on months ago, and so... I've also just been fired, Mr. Jessup. I arranged for a job with the Universal Electric Corporation. They don't mind Jews there as long as they sing at their work and find boondoggles worth $1 million a year to the company. At $3,500 a year salary. A fond farewell to all my grubby studes. Though, and Doremus thought he was at heart sadder than Loveland, I do kind of hate to give up my research. Oh, hell with them. The version of Owen J. Peasley, M.A., Oberlin, LLD, Connecticut State, president of Isaiah College, was quite different.
Why, no, Mr. Jessup. We believe absolutely in freedom of speech and thought here at Old Isaiah. The fact is that we are letting Loveland go only because the classics department is overstaffed. So little demand for Greek and Sanskrit and so on, you know, with all this modern interest in quantitative biophysics and aeroplane repairing and so on. But as to Dr. King, I'm afraid we did a little feel that he was riding for a fall, boasting about being a Jew and all, you know, and... But can't we talk of pleasanter subjects? You have probably learned that Secretary of Culture McGoblin has now completed his plan for the appointment of a director of education in each province and district, and that Professor Almeric Trout of Aubrey University is slated for director in our northeastern province? Well, I have something very gratifying to add. Dr. Trout, and what a profound scholar, what an eloquent orator he is. Did you know that in Teutonic, Almeric means noble prince? And he's been so kind as to designate me as Director of Education for the Vermont, New Hampshire District. Isn't that thrilling? I wanted you to be one of the first to hear it, Mr. Jessup, because, of course, one of the chief jobs of the director will be to work with and through the newspaper editors in the great task of spreading correct corporate ideals and combating false theories. Yes, oh yes. It seemed as though a large number of people were zealous to work with and through the editors these days, thought Doremus. He noticed that President Peasley resembled a dummy made of faded gray flannel of a quality intended for petticoats in an orphan asylum. The Minutemen's organization was less favored in the staid villages than in the industrial centers. But all through the summer it was known that a company of MMs had been formed in Fort Beulah and were drilling in the armory under National Guard officers and County Commissioner Ledoux, who was seen sitting up nights in his luxurious new room in Mrs. Ingot's boarding house, reading a manual of arms. But Doremus declined to go look at them, and when his rustic but ambitious reporter, Doc, otherwise Otis Itchett, came in throbbing about the MMs and wanted to run an illustrated account in the Saturday Informer,
Doremus sniffed. It was not till their first public parade in August that Doremus saw them, and not gladly. The whole countryside had turned out. He could hear them laughing and shuffling beneath his office window. But he stubbornly stuck to editing an article on fertilizers for cherry orchards. And he loved parades, childishly. Not even the sound of a band pounding out Bula Bula drew him to the window. Then he was plucked up by Dan Wilgus, the veteran job compositor and head of the Informer Chapel, a man tall as a house and possessed of such a sweeping black mustache as had not otherwise been seen since the passing of the old-time bartender. "You gotta take a look, boss. Great show," implored Dan. Through the Chester Arthur red-brick prissiness of President Street, Doremus saw marching a surprisingly well-drilled company of young men in the uniforms of Civil War cavalrymen, and just as they were opposite the Informer office, the town band rollicked into Marching Through Georgia. The young men smiled, they stepped more quickly, and held up their banner with the steering wheel and MM upon it. When he was 10, Doremus had seen in this selfsame street a Memorial Day parade of the GAR. The veterans were an average of under 50 then, and some of them only 35. They had swung ahead lightly and gaily, and to the tune of Marching Through Georgia. So now in 1937 he was looking down again on the veterans of Gettysburg and Missionary Ridge. Oh, he could see them all. Uncle Tom Veder, who had made him the willow whistles, old Mr. Crowley with his cornflower eyes, Jack Greenhill, who played leapfrog with the kids and who was to die in Ethan Creek. They found him with thick hair dripping. Doremus thrilled to the MM flags, the music, the valiant young men, even while he hated all they marched for, and hated the Shad Ledoux, whom he incredulously recognized, in the brawny horseman at the head of the procession. He understood now why the young men marched to war, but, "Oh, yeah, you think so," he could hear Shad sneering through the music. The unwieldy humor characteristic of American politicians persisted even through the eruption. Doremus read about and sardonically played up in the Informer, a minstrel show given at the National Convention of Boosters Clubs at Atlantic City, late in August, as end men and interlocutor appeared no less distinguished persons than Secretary of the Treasury Webster R. Skittle, Secretary of War Luthorn, and Secretary of Education and Public Relations, Dr. McGoblin. It was good old-time Elks Club humor, uncorroded by any of the notions of dignity and of international obligations which, despite his great services, that queer Stick Lee Saracen was suspected of trying to introduce. Why, marveled the boosters, the big boys were so democratic that they even kidded themselves and the corpos, that's how unassuming they were. "Who was this lady I seen you going down the street with?" demanded the plump Mr. Secretary Skittle, disguised as a colored wench in polka-dotted cotton, of Mr. Secretary Luthorn, in blackface and large red gloves.
"That wasn't no lady. That was Walt Trowbridge's paper."
"I don't think I cognosticates yous, Mr. Bones."
"Why, you know, a nance for plutocracy."
Clean fun, not too confusingly subtle, drawing the people, several millions listened on the radio to the Boosters Club show, closer to their great-hearted masters. But the high point of the show was Dr. McGoblin's daring to tease his own faction by singing,
"Buzz and booze and biz, what fun! This job gets drearier and drearier. When I get out of Washington, I'm going to Siberia."
It seemed to Doremus that he was hearing a great deal about the Secretary of Education. Then, in late September, he heard something not quite pleasant about Dr. McGoblin. The story, as he got it, ran thus. Hector McGoblin, that great surgeon, boxer, poet, sailor, had always contrived to have plenty of enemies. But after the beginning of his investigation of schools, to purge them of any teachers he did not happen to like, he made so unusually many that he was accompanied by bodyguards. At this time in September, he was in New York finding quantities of subversive elements in Columbia University. Against the protests of President Nicholas Murray Butler, who insisted that he had already cleaned out all willful and dangerous thinkers, especially the pacifists in the medical school. And McGoblin's bodyguards were two former instructors in philosophy who, in their respective universities, had been admired even by their deans for everything except the fact that they would get drunk and quarrelsome. One of them, in that state, always took off one shoe and hit people over the head with the heel if they argued in defense of Jung. With these two in uniforms as MM battalion leaders, his own was that of a brigadier, after a day usefully spent in kicking out of Columbia all teachers who had voted for Trowbridge, Dr. McGoblin started off with his brace of bodyguards to try out a wager that he could take a drink at every bar on 52nd Street and still not pass out. He had done well when, at 10:30, being then affectionate and philanthropic, he decided that it would be a splendid idea to telephone his revered former teacher in Leland Stanford, the biologist Dr. Willie Schmidt, once of Vienna, now in Rockefeller Institute. McGoblin was indignant when someone at Dr. Schmidt's apartment informed him that the doctor was out. Furiously,
"Out? Out? What do you mean he's out? Old goat like that got no right to be out? At midnight? Where is he? This is the police department speaking. Where is he?"
Dr. Schmidt was spending the evening with that gentle scholar, Rabbi Dr. Vincent de Varese. McGoblin and his learned guerrillas went to call on de Varese. On the way, nothing of note happened except that when McGoblin discussed the fare with the taxi driver, he felt impelled to knock him out. The three, and they were in the happiest, most boyish of spirits, burst joyfully into Dr. de Varese's primeval house in the 60s. The entrance hall was shabby enough, with a humble show of the good rabbi's umbrellas and storm rubbers, and had the invaders seen the bedrooms, they would have found them Trappist cells. But the long living room, front and back parlor thrown together, was half museum, half lounge. Just because he himself liked such things and resented a stranger's possessing them, McGoblin looked sniffily at a Baluchi prayer rug, a Jacobean court cupboard, a small case of incunabula, and of Arabic manuscripts in silver upon scarlet parchment.
"Swell joint. Hello, Doc. How's the Dutchman? How's the antibody research going? These are Doc Nemo and Doc Hoosis, the famous glue lifters. Great friends of mine. Introduce us to your Jew friend."
Now, it is more than possible that Rabbi de Varese had never heard of Secretary of Education McGoblin. The houseman who had let in the intruders and who nervously hovered at the living room door, he is the sole authority for most of the story, said that McGoblin staggered, slid on a rug, almost fell, then giggled foolishly as he sat down, waving his plug-ugly friends to chairs and demanding,
"Hey, Rabbi, how about some whiskey? A little scotch and soda. I know you Gayanim never lap up anything but snow-cooled nectar handed out by a maiden with a dulcimer singing of Mount Abra. Or maybe just a little shot of Christian children's sacrificial blood."
"Just a joke, Rabbi. I know these protocols of the Elders of Zion are all the bunk, but awful handy in propaganda just the same. But I mean for plain goyim like us, a little real hooch. Hear me?"
Dr. Schmidt started to protest. The rabbi, who had been carding his white beard, silenced him, and with a wave of his fragile old hand signaled the waiting houseman, who reluctantly brought in whiskey and siphons. The three coordinators of culture almost filled their glasses before they poured in the soda.
"Look here, de Varese, why don't you kikes take a tumble to yourselves and get out? Beat it. Eggsy and bearing corpses.
and start a real Zion, say in South America.
The rabbi looked bewildered at the attack. Dr. Schmidt snorted,
Dr. McGoblin, once a promising pupil of mine, is Secretary of Education and a lot of things. I don't know what, at Washington. Corpo.
Oh, the rabbi sighed. I have heard of that cult, but my people have learned to ignore persecution. We have been so impudent as to adopt the tactics of your early Christian martyrs. Even if we were invited to your corporate feast, which I understand we most warmly are not, I am afraid we should not be able to attend. You see, we believe in only one dictator, God, and I am afraid we cannot see Mr. Windrip as a rival to Jehovah.
Well, that's all baloney, murmured one of the learned gunmen, and McGoblin shouted,
Oh, can the $2 words! There's just one thing where we agree with the dirty, kike-loving communists. That's in chucking the whole bunch of divinities, Jehovah and all the rest of them, that have been on relief so long.
The rabbi was unable even to answer, but little Dr. Schmidt, he had a donut mustache, a beer belly, and black button boots with soles half an inch thick, said,
McGoblin, I suppose I may talk frank with an old student, there not being any reporters or loudspeakers around. Do you know why you are drinking like a pig? Because you are ashamed. Ashamed that you, once a promising researcher, should have sold out to freebooters with brains like decayed liver and...
That'll do from you, Prof. Say, we ought to tie those seditious sons of hounds up and beat the daylight out of them,
whimpered one of the watchdogs.
McGoblin shrieked,
You highbrows, you stinking intellectuals! You kike with your lush, luxurious library, while common people been starving. Would be now if the chief hadn't saved them. Your collection books, stolen from the pennies of your poor, dumb, foot-kissing congregation of pushcart peddlers.
The rabbi sat bespelled, fingering his beard, but Dr. Schmidt leaped up, crying,
You three scoundrels were not invited here. You push your way in. Get out. Go. Get out.
One of the accompanying dogs demanded of McGoblin,
Gonna stand for these two yiddles insulting us? Insulting the whole by-God corpo state in the MM uniform? Kill 'em.
Now, to his already abundant priming, McGoblin had added two huge whiskies since he had come. He yanked out his automatic pistol, fired twice. Dr. Schmidt toppled. Rabbi DeVarez slid down in his chair, his temple throbbing out blood. The houseman trembled at the door, and one of the guards shot at him, then chased him down the street, firing and whooping with the humor of the joke. This learned guard was killed instantly at a street crossing by a traffic policeman. McGoblin and the other guard were arrested and brought before the commissioner of the Metropolitan District, the great Corpo Viceroy, whose power was that of three or four state governors put together. Dr. DeVarez, though he was not yet dead, was too sunken to testify, but the commissioner thought that in a case so closely touching the federal government, it would not be seemly to postpone the trial. Against the terrified evidence of the rabbi's Russian-Polish houseman were the earnest, and by now sober, accounts of the Federal Secretary of Education and of his surviving aide, formerly Assistant Professor of Philosophy in Palouse University. It was proven that not only DeVarez but also Dr. Schmidt was a Jew, which, incidentally, he 100% was not. It was almost proven that this sinister pair had been coaxing innocent corpos into DeVarez's house and performing upon them what a scared little Jewish stool pigeon called ritual murders. McGoblin and friend were acquitted on grounds of self-defense and handsomely complimented by the commissioner, and later in telegrams from President Windrip and Secretary of State Saracen, for having defended the Commonwealth against human vampires and one of the most horrifying plots known in history. The policeman who had shot the other guard wasn't, so scrupulous was Corpo Justice, heavily punished, merely sent out to a dreary beat in the Bronx. So everybody was happy. But Doremus Jessup, on receiving a letter from a New York reporter who had talked privately with the surviving guard, was not so happy. He was not in a very gracious temper anyway. County Commissioner Shad Ledoux, on grounds of humanitarianism, had made him discharge his delivery boys and employ MMs to distribute, or cheerfully chuck into the river, the informer.
"Last straw. Plenty last," he raged.
He had read about Rabbi de Varez and seen pictures of him. He had once heard Dr. Willie Schmidt speak, when the State Medical Association had met at Fort Beulah, and afterward had sat near him at dinner. If they were murderous Jews, then he was a murderous Jew too, he swore, and it was time to do something for his own people. That evening, it was late in September 1937, he did not go home to dinner at all, but, with a paper container of coffee and a slab of pie untouched before him, he stooped at his desk in the informer office, writing an editorial which, when he had finished it, he marked, "Must, 12-point boldface, box, top front page." The beginning of the editorial, to appear the following morning, was, "Believing that the inefficiency and crimes of the Corpo administration were due to the difficulties attending a new form of government, we have waited patiently for their end. We apologize to our readers for that patience. It is easy to see now in the revolting crime of a drunken cabinet member against two innocent and valuable old men like Dr. Schmidt and the Reverend Dr. de Varez, that we may expect nothing but murderous extirpation of all honest opponents of the tyranny of Windrip and his Corpo gang. Not that all of them are as vicious as McGoblin. Some are merely incompetent, like our friends Ledoux, Reek, and Hake. But their ludicrous incapability permits the homicidal cruelty of their chieftains to go on without check. Buzzard Windrip, the chief, and his pirate gang..." A smallish, neat, gray-bearded man, furiously rattling an aged typewriter, typing with his two forefingers. Dan Wilgus, head of the composing room, looked and barked like an old sergeant, and, like an old sergeant, was only theoretically meek to his superior officer. He was shaking when he brought in this copy and, almost rubbing Doremus's nose in it, protested, "Say, boss, you don't honest to God think we're going to set this up, do you?" "I certainly do." "Well, I don't. Rattlesnake poison. It's all right you're getting thrown in the hooscow and probably shot at dawn, if you like that kind of sport, but we've held a meeting of the chapel, and we all say, damned if we'll risk our necks, too." "All right, you yellow pup. All right, Dan, I'll set it myself."
"Oh, don't. Gosh, I don't want to have to go to your funeral after the MMs get through with you and say, don't he look unnatural."
"After working for me for 20 years, Dan. Traitor."
"Look here. I'm no Enoch Arden, what the hell was his name? Ethan Frome or Benedict Arnold or whatever it was. And more'n once I've licked some galoot that was standing around a saloon telling the world you were the lousiest highbrow editor in Vermont. And at that, I guess maybe he was telling the truth, but same time..." Dan's effort to be humorous and coaxing broke, and he wailed, "God, boss, please don't."
"I know, Dan. Probably our friend Shad Ledoux will be annoyed. But I can't go on standing things like slaughtering old de Varez anymore, and... Here, give me that copy."
While compositors, pressmen, and the young devil stood alternately fretting and snickering at his clumsiness, Doremus ranged up before a typecase, in his left hand the first composing stick he had held in 10 years, and looked doubtfully at the case. It was like a labyrinth to him.
"Forgot how it's arranged. Can't find anything except the E-box," he complained.
"Hell, I'll do it. All you pussyfooters, get the hell out of this. You don't know one doggone thing about who set this up," Dan Wilgus roared, and the other printers vanished as far as the toilet door.
In the editorial office, Doremus showed proofs of his indiscretion to Doc Itchett, that enterprising though awkward reporter, and to Julian Falk, who was off now to Amherst, but who had been working for The Informer all summer, combining unprintable articles on Adam Smith with extremely printable accounts of golf and dances at the country club.
"Gee, I hope you will have the nerve to go on and print it. At the same time, I hope you don't. They'll get you," worried Julian.
"Nah, go on and print it. They won't dare to do a thing. They may get funny in New York and Washington, but you're too strong in the Beulah Valley for Ledoux and Staubmeyer to dare lift a hand," brayed Doc Itchett, while Doremus considered, "I wonder if this smart young journalistic Judas wouldn't like to see me in trouble and get hold of The Informer and turn it corpo."
He did not stay at the office till the paper with his editorial had gone to press. He went home early and showed the proof to Emma and Sissy. While they were reading it with yelps of disapproval, Julian Falk slipped in. Emma protested,
"Oh, you can't! You mustn't do it! What will become of us all? Honestly, Dormouse, I'm not scared for myself, but what would I do if they beat you or put you in prison or something? It would just break my heart to think of you in a cell, and without any clean underclothes. It isn't too late to stop it, is it?"
"No, as a matter of fact, the paper doesn't go to bed till 11. Sissy, what do you think?"
"I don't know what to think. Oh, damn."
"Why, Sissy," from Emma, quite mechanically.
"It used to be you did what was right and got a nice stick of candy for it," said Sissy. "Now it seems as if whatever's right is wrong.
Julian, funny face, what do you think of Pop's kicking Shad in his sweet hairy ears?"
"Why, sis,"
Julian blurted, "I think it'd be fierce if somebody didn't try to stop these fellows. I wish I could do it, but how could I?"
"You've probably answered the whole business," said Doremus. "If a man is going to assume the right to tell several thousand readers what's what, most agreeable hitherto, he's got a kind of, you might say, priestly obligation to tell the truth. Oh, cursed spite. Well, I think I'll drop into the office again. Home about midnight. Don't sit up, anybody. And Sissy and you, Julian, that particularly goes for you two night prowlers. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And in Vermont, that means going to bed."
"And alone," murmured Sissy.
"Why, Cecilia Jessup!"
As Doremus trotted out, Foolish, who had sat adoring him, jumped up, hoping for a run. Somehow, more than all of Emma's imploring, the dog's familiar devotion made Doremus feel what it might be to go to prison. He had lied. He did not return to the office. He drove up the valley to the tavern and to Lorinda Pike. But on the way he stopped in at the home of his son-in-law, bustling young Dr. Fowler Greenhill, not to show him the proof, but to have, perhaps in prison, another memory of the domestic life in which he had been rich. He stepped quietly into the front hall of the Greenhill house, a jaunty imitation of Mount Vernon, very prosperous and secure, gay with the brass-knobbed walnut furniture and painted Russian boxes which Mary Greenhill affected. Doremus could hear David, but surely it was past his bedtime. What time did 9-year-old kids go to bed these degenerate days? Excitedly chattering with his father, and his father's partner, old Dr. Marcus Olmsted, who was almost retired but who kept up the obstetrics and eye and ear work for the firm. Doremus peeped into the living room with its bright curtains of yellow linen. David's mother was writing letters, a crisp, fashionable figure at a maple desk, complete with yellow quill pen, engraved notepaper, and silver-backed blotter. Fowler and David were lounging on the two wide arms of Dr. Olmsted's chair.
"So you don't think you'll be a doctor like your dad and me?" Dr. Olmsted was quizzing.
David's soft hair fluttered as he bobbed his head in the agitation of being taken seriously by grown-ups.
Oh, yes, I would like to. Oh, I think it'd be slick to be a doctor, but I want to be a newspaper, like Granddad. That'd be a wow, you said it."
David, where did you ever pick up such language?
You see, Uncle Doctor, a doctor, oh, gee, he has to stay up all night. But an editor, he just sits in his office and takes it easy and never has to worry about nothing.
That moment, Fowler Greenhill saw his father-in-law making monkey faces at him from the door and admonished David.
Now, not always. Editors have to work pretty hard sometimes. Just think of when there's train wrecks and floods and everything.
I'll tell you. Did you know I have magic power?
What's magic power, Daddy?
I'll show you. I'll summon your granddad here from Misty Deeps.
But will he come? Grunted Dr. Olmsted.
And have him tell you all the troubles an editor has. Just make him come flying through the air.
Aw, gee, you couldn't do that, Dad.
Oh, can't I? Fowler stood solemnly, the overhead lights making soft his harsh red hair. And he windmilled his arms, hooting, Presto, Vesto, Adsit! Granddad Jessup, voila! And there, coming through the doorway, sure enough, was Granddad Jessup.
Doremus remained only 10 minutes, saying to himself, Anyway, nothing bad can happen here in this solid household. When Fowler saw him to the door, Doremus sighed to him, Wish Davy were right. Just had to sit in the office and not worry. But I suppose some day I'll have a run-in with the corpos.
I hope not. Nasty bunch.
What do you think, Dad? That swine Shadladoo told me yesterday they wanted me to join the MMs as medical officer.
Fat chance. I told him so.
Watch out for Shad, Fowler. He's vindictive. Made us rewire our whole building.
I'm not scared of Captain General Ledoux or 50 like him. Hope he calls me in for a bellyache some day. I'll give him a good sedative, potassium of cyanide. Maybe I'll some day have the pleasure of seeing that gent in his coffin. That's the advantage the doctor has, you know. Good night, Dad. Sleep tight.
A good many tourists were still coming up from New York to view the colored autumn of Vermont, and when Doremus arrived at the Beulah Valley Tavern, he had irritably to wait while Lorinda dug out extra towels and looked up train schedules and was polite to old ladies who complained that there was too much or not enough sound from the Beulah River Falls at night. He could not talk to her apart until after 10. There was, meanwhile, a curious exalted luxury in watching each lost minute threaten him with the approach of the final press time, as he sat in the tea room, imperturbably scratching through the leaves of the latest fortune. Lorinda led him at 10:15 into her little office, just a roll-top desk, a desk chair, one straight chair, and a table piled with heaps of defunct hotel magazines. It was spinsterishly neat, yet smelled still of the cigar smoke and old letter files of proprietors long since gone.
"Let's hurry, Dor. I'm having a little dust-up with that snipe nipper."
She plumped down at the desk.
"Linda, read this proof. For tomorrow's paper. No, wait. Stand up."
"Eh?"
He himself took the desk chair and pulled her down on his knees.
"Oh, you," she snorted,
but she nuzzled her cheek against his shoulder and murmured contentedly.
"Read this, Linda. For tomorrow's paper. I think I'm going to publish it all right. Got to decide finally before 11, but ought I to? I was sure when I left the office, but Emma was scared. Oh, Emma! Sit still, let me see it."
She read quickly. She always did. At the end, she said emotionlessly,
"Yes, you must run it. Doremus. They've actually come to us here, the corpos. It's like reading about typhus in China and suddenly finding it in your own house."
She rubbed his shoulder with her cheek again and raged,
"Think of it. That Shad Ledoux. And I taught him for a year in district school, though I was only 2 years older than he was. And what a nasty bully he was, too. He came to me a few days ago, and he had the nerve to propose that if I would give lower rates to the MMs, he sort of hinted it would be nice of me to serve MM officers free, They would close their eyes to my selling liquor here without a license or anything. Why, he had the inconceivable nerve to tell me, and condescendingly, my dear, that he and his fine friends would be willing to hang out here a lot. Even Staubmeyer. Oh, our professor is blossoming out as quite a sporting character. And when I chased Ledoux out with a flea in his ear, well, just this morning I got a notice that I have to appear in the county court tomorrow. Some complaint from my endearing partner, Mr. Nipper. Seems he isn't satisfied with the division of our work here. And honestly, my darling, he never does one blame thing but sit around and bore my best customers to death by telling what a swell hotel he used to have in Florida. And Nipper has taken his things out of here and moved into town. I'm afraid I'll have an unpleasant time trying to keep from telling him what I think of him in court.
Good Lord. Look, sweet, have you got a lawyer for it?
Lawyer? Heavens, no. Just a misunderstanding on little Nipper's part.
You'd better. The corpos are using the courts for all sorts of graft and for accusations of sedition. Get Mungo Kitterick, my lawyer.
He's dumb. Ice water in his veins.
I know, but he's a tidier-up like so many lawyers. Likes to see everything all neat in pigeonholes. He may not care a damn for justice, but he'll be awfully pained by any irregularities. Please get him, Lindy, because they've got Effingham Swan presiding at court tomorrow.
Who?
Swan, the military judge for District 3. That's a new corpo office. Kind of circuit judge with court-martial powers. This Effingham Swan, I had Doc Itchett interview him today when he arrived, he's the perfect gentleman fascist, Oswald Mosley style. Good family, whatever that means. Harvard graduate, Columbia Law School, year at Oxford. But went into finance in Boston. Investment banker, major or something during the war, plays polo and sailed in a yacht race to Bermuda. Itchett says he's a big brute with manners smoother than a butterscotch sundae and more language than a bishop. But I'll be glad to have a gentleman to explain things to instead of Shad. A gentleman's blackjack hurts just as much as a mucker's.
Oh, you, with irritated tenderness, running her forefinger along the line of his jaw. Outside, a footstep. She sprang up, sat down primly in the straight chair. The footsteps went by. She mused. All this trouble and the corpos. They're going to do something to you and me. We'll become so roused up that either we'll be desperate and really cling to each other and everybody else in the world can go to the devil, or what I'm afraid is more likely, we'll get so deep into rebellion against Windrip, we'll feel so terribly that we're standing for something, that we'll want to give up everything else for it, even give up you and me, so that no one can ever find out and criticize. We'll have to be beyond criticism.
No, I won't listen. We will fight. But how can we ever get so involved, detached people like us?
You are going to publish that editorial tomorrow?
Yes.
It's not too late to kill it?
He looked at the clock over her desk, so ludicrously like a grade school clock that it ought to have been flanked with portraits of George and Martha.
Well, yes, it is too late. Almost 11. Couldn't get to the office till way past. You're sure you won't worry about it when you go to bed tonight? Dear, I so don't want you to worry. You sure you don't want to telephone and kill the editorial?
Sure. Absolute.
I'm glad. Me, I'd rather be shot than go sneaking around, crippled with fear. Bless you.
She kissed him and hurried off to another hour or two of work, while he drove home, whistling vaingloriously. But he did not sleep well in his big black walnut bed. He startled to the night noises of an old frame house, the easing walls, the step of bodiless assassins creeping across the wooden floors all night long. Chapter 19.
An honest propagandist for any cause, that is, one who honestly studies and figures out the most effective way of putting over his message, will learn fairly early that it is not fair to ordinary folks, it just confuses them, to try to make them swallow all the true facts that would be suitable to a higher class of people. And one seemingly small but almighty important point he learns, if he does much speechifying, is that you can win over folks to your point of view much better in the evening, when they are tired out from work and not so likely to resist you, than at any other time of day. 0 hour, Berzelius Windrip. The Fort Beulah Informer had its own three-story and basement building, on President Street between Elm and Maple, opposite the side entrance of the Hotel Wessex. On the top story was the composing room, on the second the editorial and photographic departments and the bookkeeper, in the basement the presses, and on the first or street floor the circulation and advertising departments, and the front office open to the pavement, where the public came to pay subscriptions and insert want ads. The private room of the editor, Doremus Jessup, looked out on President Street through one not-too-dirty window. It was larger but little more showy than Lorinda Pike's office at the tavern, but on the wall it did have historic treasures in the way of a water-stained surveyor's map of Fort Beulah Township in 1891, a contemporary oleograph portrait of President McKinley, complete with eagles, flags, cannon, and the Ohio State flower, the scarlet carnation, a group photograph of the New England Editorial Association, in which Doremus was the third blur in a derby hat in the fourth row, and an entirely bogus copy of a newspaper announcing Lincoln's death. It was reasonably tidy. In the patent letter file, otherwise empty, there were only 2.5 pairs of winter mittens and an 18-gauge shotgun shell. Doremus was, by habit, extremely fond of his office. It was the only place aside from his study at home that was thoroughly his own. He would have hated to leave it or to share it with anyone, possibly excepting Buck and Lorinda, and every morning he came to it expectantly from the ground floor, up the wide brown stairs, through the good smell of printer's ink. He stood at the window of this room before 8, the morning when his editorial appeared, looking down at the people going to work in shops and warehouses. A few of them were in Minutemen uniforms. More and more even the part-time MMs wore their uniforms when on civilian duties. There was a bustle among them. He saw them unfold copies of the Informer. He saw them look up, point up, at his window. Heads close, they irritably discussed the front page of the paper. R.C. Crowley went by, early as ever, on his way to open the bank, and stopped to speak to a clerk from Ed Howland's grocery, both of them shaking their heads. Old Dr. Olmsted, Fowler's partner, and Louis Rotenstern halted on a corner. Doremus knew they were both friends of his, but they were dubious, perhaps frightened, as they looked at an Informer. The passing of people became a gathering, the gathering a crowd, the crowd a mob, glaring up at his office, beginning to clamor. There were dozens of people there unknown to him. Respectable farmers in town for shopping, unrespectables in town for a drink, laborers from the nearest work camp, and all of them eddying around MM uniforms. Probably many of them cared nothing about insults to the corpo state, but had only the unprejudiced impersonal pleasure in violence natural to most people. Their mutter became louder, less human, more like the snap of burning rafters. Their glances joined in one. He was, frankly, scared. He was half-conscious of Big Dan Wilgus, the head compositor beside him, hand on his shoulder but saying nothing, and of Doc Itchett cackling, my gracious, I hope they don't come up here. The mob acted then, swift and together, on no more of an incitement than an unknown MM's shout. Ought to burn the place! Lynch the whole bunch of traitors! They were running across the street into the front office. He could hear a sound of smashing, and his fright was gone in protective fury.
He galloped down the wide stairs and from 5 steps above the front office looked on the mob, equipped with axes and brush hooks grabbed from in front of Pridewell's nearby hardware store, slashing at the counter facing the front door, breaking the glass case of souvenir postcards and stationery samples, and with obscene hands reaching across the counter to rip the blouse of the girl